Let's talk. John Brown. The medieval pilgrim, the road to salvation since the early days of mankind. There seems to have been an urge to travel, the undertaking of arduous journeys to visit a sacred and magical place seems to be an integral part of the human psyche. I'm delighted to say that this new book, talking about the peak of English pilgrimage, is called The Medieval Pilgrim. It's by Michael Brown, no relation. I say that Michael joins me live on the line now from somewhere probably on the road to Antioch. Michael, good morning to you, sire.
Good morning. I'm stuck in my front room, I'm afraid.
And where is your front room somewhere towards Canterbury? I mean, have you got a shrine to Becket in the corner? What's going on there, Michael?
No, we are in Northamptonshire, not the most famous pilgrimage place in the world, but we do have a relic of Thomas a Becket in Northampton Cathedral. So
right, well that's because now I'm just going to
Canterbury, I suppose.
Yeah, that gets my what's it's flowing. So tell me a little bit about yourself, and apart from having a wonderful surname, Brown, which is a mark of a fine historian. So why are you eminently suited to write this particular book on pilgrimages?
Well, many years ago, I joined the medieval society. This was before it really caught on. We used to make our own armour. We had combat. We made bows and arrows. We had banquets. And we always said we ought to do a pilgrimage. And nothing happened as usual. And then one day I read a bit in the Northampton paper and it said somebody had hitchhiked along the way to Canterbury. And I thought, God, that's cheating. We're going to walk. So I did, with two others who both failed to complete the walk.
Yeah.
So I arrived on my own, and having done it once, I thought, yeah, great, done it once, that'll do. And then the next year I thought, we'll do it again. And it's been going on now for 44 years. So I've got quite a bit of experience at making pilgrimages.
Right.
And every time that my official pilgrimages, we actually dress up in medieval costume and carry as much medieval kit as we can.
Okay, if you're carrying as much medieval kit as you can, and used to make weapons, are you carrying a concealed morning star then or something on your what's going on?
We're not allowed to do that. Although when we walked to France, my mates had daggers on their belts, and the only time they were asked to take them off was when we got to Montmichel, and they even let us on the ferry. So times have changed.
Fair enough. So what, just for those, I mean, who may not, because we all know, you know, we've all got a relatively good idea about a pilgrimage, but when was the idea of... Why did the idea of pilgrimage sort of really take off in... it's a whole encompassing sort of catch-all, the Middle Ages. I mean, presumably we're talking really Plantagenet England Middle Ages.
For me, yes, but it goes back a lot longer. I mean, more or less right from the first century, people are going to the Holy Land to see where Jesus was being walked, you know, visit the places he'd been to, go and visit the later on it's basically a package tour, like it's going on holiday today. You arrange things through somebody else because it wasn't always safe. And you would visit Bethlehem. You would go to St. Catherine's, whose body miraculously was transported by angels after she died. And you would just try and do as much as you could. But later on, the church brings in indulgences.
Yeah.
A dodgy business deal. It's sort of an insurance policy against on the afterlife. You could get a full indulgence, which meant basically you go straight to heaven, that's it. You still have to suffer pay for some of your sins, but you're not hanging around in purgatory, which is sort of being stuck in the airport for about 3 hours before you go on to where you really want to go, sort of idea. So partial indulgences meant you still had to hang around until the judgment day, sort of thing. And they would offer lots and lots of different days off purgatory, so you could sort of not hang around as much as you ought to, perhaps. And that started meaning that places like Rome would offer you indulgences for going to different churches. Santiago de Compostela, of course, not that far from where you are at the moment, was also another good one. And from England, it was the closest, and you wouldn't walk the way everybody does nowadays. You sail simply over to Coruña and walk the last bit, which sounds pretty cushy, except in the sailing ship, crossing the Bay of Biscay, even today, is a bit dodgy. In those days, it was Very dodgy. You're being tossed and turned all over the place. There's this wonderful medieval poem from England saying about how the pilgrims get on the boat and they're all suffering from seasickness. They're wanting dry toast to help settle their stomachs and a drop of Malmsey. Something not recommended today. And, they get there and then they've got about a five-day walk that goes to Santiago. Then they've got to walk back to the coast again and they've got the same horrible boat trip back home. So it wasn't as cushy as it might sound.
Because when we think of pilgrimage, Mike, we tend to think like, you know, it's people sort of barefoot and sackcloth and ashes, you know, heading to the Holy Land and then taking... I mean, we've got to sort of differentiate between sort of pilgrimage and crusade, haven't we? If we're talking Holy Land, because it's not all sort of trudging along. As I said before, some people are taking boat trips. Some people are going, you know, via Sicily. You know, don't have to work their way through the Seljuk Turks, for example. So, you know, it's not a one size fits all. You can do you can go five star, or you can go, as you said, Ryanair, basically.
Well, the thing was, as then, it depends on how much money you got. I mean, and even that didn't mean you're safe. I mean, one of the close to the royal families in the 1400s, he went to Rome and got robbed with a huge entourage of knights. So, I mean, it could happen to anybody. And the Pope, in his case, because he was rich, the Pope actually issues a thing saying, if anybody can catch these people, please do. And you'll get absolved from sins for doing so. But for the average person, actually, you don't go to the Holy Land. Most people can't afford it.
Yeah.
You might not even come home again. And people wrote their wills before they did, just in case. But for me, living here in Northamptonshire, I might trudge off to a local shrine that's only a day away, because that's all the time I can get off work and all I can afford. If you've got a bit more cash, you might go further afield to places like Canterbury. Perhaps you could go up to Walsingham in Norfolk, both places people still go. You might try and go abroad. But if you're going abroad, you start from your front door, you get to the coast, you have to get a boat to get across the sea. And then you either go by horse, if you can afford that, or you've got to trudge all the way to Rome. And once you get to Rome, many people would carry on to Venice, and then they would catch a boat down to the Holy Land. So it's what you can afford, really. But the Venetians have got a nice little sideline in sort of package holidays. You booked your boat, and the standard of that depends on how much money you've got, of course. You had to take your own chamber pots, your own bedding, and things. They recommend you buy a cage for some chickens, so you've got some eggs.
Right.
And even take your own wine, because the wine they give you on the boats isn't really very good at all. And even then, you might get captured by pirates or anything else on the way, or sink in a storm. So even the cushier ways aren't that pleasant, really.
I mean, can we just sort of, before we get, I mean, because I could wax lyrical about, you know, going to Venice and that, yeah, you said it's a nice little dinner for Venetians. I mean, absolutely. But also, let's keep it sort of homegrown to the UK, because, you know, one of the most famous texts in the whole of English literature are the Canterbury Tales. And, you know, spoiler alert, that's about pilgrimage. So it really does say something about, you know, the cult of Becket. So explain to me a little bit, or to listeners at least, why Becket is such a cult figure, and why, I mean, it's all Henry II's fault, really, who will rid me of this turbulent priest, etc. But why, you know, why Canterbury and visiting Becket's tomb is the most popular away day for your average British pilgrim?
Well, to start, Becket's an archbishop. He's murdered within his own cathedral, and strictly speaking, any church was sacrosanct, and you could seek shelter there, and nobody was supposed to be able to harm you or drag you out. And in some cases, you could stay there for 40 days and then you'd be forced to leave the country. So the actual fact that they killed an archbishop in his own cathedral went across Europe like wildfire. I mean, that's the nowadays it'd be across all the media pages.
TikToking,
people people came from all over the continent, and even from places like Norway, to come and see Tray at Becket's tomb. So they have the site of where he was actually murdered, and you'll see a big jaggy sword thing over there to mark the place. And the steps are actually worn from the number of pilgrims who have walked there over all these years. And then you'd have a piece of his skull to venerate.
There were quite a few pieces of his skull around, weren't they? Because if you read the reports of what happened, I mean, it wasn't a clean kill, shall we say.
No, I mean, what was supposed to have happened is somebody bought up his sword, swiped it down, took off the top of Beckett's skull, licked his brains out and said he won't get up again.
And those of you having your boiled eggs for breakfast this morning, I must apologise, but there you go.
So what the monks do is they mop up all the blood, quick-thinking businessmen as they are, and they soak this in barrels of water, which is sold as Beckett's holy water for the next several centuries until Henry bans it. So it's pretty diluted by the 1500s. And this is supposed to cure anything. And one of the things they say is Beckett is the best physician. Doctors being expensive and not very reliable. If you go to Beckett, the chances are you'll be cured. And people would go for cures. There's one bit about, if you go into stained glass windows, one of the more gory stories is somebody gets castrated for something and he goes to Beckett to pray and he's restored.
Hurrah, hurrah.
Hurrah. So some of them a little bit far-fetched. And another one is but all these windows around the shrine area, and that's publicity.
Yeah.
It's like flicking through Facebook and all the ads keep popping up. I mean, it's telling you what Beckett's done and why you should be there and why you should give him lots of money. That's the other thing. You leave lots of offerings if you can. And Beckett's shrine was giving gifts from people all over Europe. There was a big particular ruby that was supposed to be given by the King of France, which somehow disappeared when Henry had everything taken away. But these shrines are generating money. The more pilgrims you get, the more money you've got. You can rebuild your cathedral or church. You can make the display greater so more people will then go. But people do sort of get, saints come and go. But Beckett was one of the ones that sort of stayed the course.
Yeah.
And even some of the saints are a bit dubious. We had one in Northampton who he'd robbed some Jews in Stamford, come to Northampton, taken board and lodgings next to one of the churches, and his landlord basically murders him, takes all the money and lobs his body over the wall. And he then becomes attributed as being a saint, and all these people are basically going along to pray to some guy who was actually a murderer and a crook. And the Bishop of Lincoln has to come down and ban them from doing it. So it's not all pious.
Yeah. I mean, and
it's
not
a business opportunity as well.
If you look at the descriptions, I mean, pilgrims going out to Canterbury and other places, they're not solemn occasions, are they? I mean, there's almost a carnival atmosphere to it. If you read the various tales, Wife of Bath, etc., I mean, they're having a whale of a time, aren't they?
Well, she is. But there is a real life Wife of Bath.
Oh, do tell more. Come on.
Well, she's a bit more pious than that one. But she's Marjorie Kemp, who comes from King's Lynn. She's had quite a few children. She's probably suffering from postnatal depression, as we'd say nowadays. She gets visions of Jesus coming to talk to her. She imagines she's actually at the Nativity and she's helping Mary prepare the swaddling clothes and whatever. And she's the sort of person you don't want in your group. Now, most pilgrims travel in groups because it's safer.
Yeah.
So, especially if you're going abroad. Marjorie Kemp is prone to these great outbursts. So she'll have a vision and she'll start rolling on the floor and crying and sobbing. And everybody else is sort of nudge, let's get away from her. She's a bit embarrassing. And this happens to her all the time. I mean, basically, they abandon her when she's going to Venice to go to the Holy Land, and she's left with her maidservant, and she abandons her as well. But she gets everywhere. She's been to Jerusalem, she's been to Rome, she's been to Santiago, she's done most of the sites in England. She's accused of being a heretic, which isn't good because you could be burned at that.
Sure, yeah.
And she manages to survive that. And she's in constant fear of her life on the travels from being attacked and raped or even being burnt as a heretic. And yet she carries on. And she writes or dictates the first autobiography in English. So that's what she's known for now. And she's much more famous now, perhaps, than she ever was during her own lifetime.
So if you're going to the
idea,
if you're going to the Holy Land and you, so you've got, you know, you've got across, you know, you've got through Central, you've got to Venice, you got your chickens in your case, you've got your homegrown wine or whatever. When you get to the Holy Land, I mean, is it like you're landing at the airport and there's somebody holding a flag saying, Malmesbury lot this way? I mean, what's the sort of setup when you actually get there?
Well, certainly in later times, you've got there, you've taken months to actually get there, but now you've only got about 2 weeks. You've got licenses from the Arabs, but the first bit is you land and you have to sit in the cave all night while they sort out your pages, documents.
Right.
This is rather unpleasant. You have to stay in this cave out the way. It's guarded for your own safety as much as anything else. And then all the local Arabs are coming along trying to sell you food and things like that. Then you have to choose some donkeys, which are going to be used for transport to get you to perhaps to Jerusalem from there, where you've landed. And there's a mad rush to get the best donkeys.
Right. Anybody who's been to Tangier in the old days, like 10 years ago, you know, because we're based just a short hop away over from Tangier and Gibraltar and all that lot. So anybody who's been to went to Tangier in the 90s will, this is very, very familiar.
You need your own water for that and everything, and your own food to get there as well. Having got in Jerusalem, you're under strict orders to stay in certain areas. Men are told not to go out on their own. Right. And whatever you do, do not look at the women, because it's just asking for trouble and you might end up being dead. So it's very, very strictly controlled. And then you're taken on package tours to Bethlehem and Mount Zion and things like that. So it's very much see as much as you can, because you'll probably never get there again. And then you're brought back to base. Back to the thing, back to the cave on the shore, and then you've got to get your boat home back to Venice, yeah. And then you've got to get all the way back to England. I mean, it's an incredible undertaking. I mean, most people on pilgrimages today, when I first started walking, they expected us to arrive by bus, not walked at all. But most people will walk to Santiago. They'll start at Sarria or Saint Jean-Pierre-de-Port. You get to Santiago, and you do what I did, you catch a plane. In the medieval time, you had to walk back again.
Yeah.
So it was a much tougher proposition.
What's the... Do you have reports of these people it being, you know... Because, I mean, if we were Americans, we'd go, they went on a journey, and their lives changed. But, I mean, do you have reports of people coming back and having, you know, having been to the Holy Land? Because, I mean, again, it's quite an undertaking, because I said before, you know, Saladin has retaken Jerusalem in whatever, the 12th century, and so it's not like you can have a wander around and a few selfies. So, they have seen different cultures that they can only never have imagined, you know, firsthand. Do people come back, hopefully change for the better from the whole experience?
Get into that. You've got to believe it quite strongly in the first place. So, I mean, you're a Catholic, you go to places you want to see, you come back a Catholic, that's unlikely to change. But one or two people will be perhaps go into a monastery or become a nun. Some of them become hermits and they look after bridges and roads and dedicate the rest of their life to serving other people. But quite a lot of them just carry on life as usual, like today, really. But maybe a little bit changed, yes. And you could live on those stories for years.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, when I was in Jerusalem, this happened and that
down
happened.
Down the alehouse.
Buying you a drink.
Down the alehouse in Market Harbour. I go, oh, well, you know, when I was having a quick pint with the Knights Templar the other day, I mean, I can see it. No, just, but I'm just, I wasn't aware of this, but you see, because here we are in Ethben, as we call it, and... That we, you know, friends of mine, a very good friend of mine, has done the whole of the, has done Camino twice, but he started from Saint-Jean. I mean, he did the full 5 weeks on foot, and he's got a sort of, we call them the three dayers, because they come in 3 days out from, so it's, you're basically pretty much on your own apart from a hardcore, until you get 3 days away from Santiago de Compostela, and then suddenly it gets much busier. And so he's just like that. He took a route which went south and he did a flanking maneuver, yeah? Carrying coconuts a la Holy Grail, I'm just intrigued by the way that actually that's not a new practice for people just to arrive 3 days out and then say they've done the route.
thing is, you in those days, you still got to get to those 3 days out. I mean, they didn't care. Yeah. The big problem nowadays is if you want to get your certificate to say you've got walked to Santiago, you have to walk the minimum distance. But in those days, you would have had to do the whole lot, whether you wanted to or not, so to speak. So this is sort of causing a bit of a backlog. But in those days, it didn't matter how you got there. All that mattered was you got there. And you can hop on a plane, and you've got to cross the sea somehow from England anyway, so that that's impossible to do otherwise. And then you walked or you rode, either of which is pretty tough. And I've walked across the plains in Spain as well. And it was said to have been the coldest summer for 30 years, and that was absolute nightmare, even the worst one. How people are getting on this year, I do not know.
Just don't even go. Go there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was tough. It's still tough in places. There's no way around it.
Here's the thing,
unless you go and buy a bike or something.
Yeah. How did you put this all together? I mean, where are you getting your sources from for the Medieval Pilgrim?
You've got, as I say, you've got Chaucer for the more light-hearted version, but there are lots of people who've left accounts. There's William of Eton. He went on journeys. He tells us how he travelled. There are bits describing the route from England, stage by stage, telling you the alternative routes if somebody's at war with somebody else, how much it's going to cost you, what all the different currencies are. Don't use that currency because actually it's a bit dodgy. Stick to this one and they'll still accept it. Don't drink. When you're going across Spain, there's a famous book written from the early, about the 1100s, just before, and it's telling you to watch out for dodgy water supplies, people that have ferry you across a river and then tip you in halfway across.
So this is ye olde rough guide to pilgrimage, isn't it, basically?
Yeah. And all right, some of these weren't commonly spread around, but somebody wrote, went from Germany, and he's not sure whether he should go to the Holy Land. So he asks the local count what he should do, and the count tells him, well, there are three things that you should never advise on anybody on. The first one's getting married, the second one's going off to the wars, and the third one's going on a long pilgrimage. You can't advise somebody on it because, you know, whatever happens, it's going to be your fault. So it's down to you. And in the end, Brother Felix decides he'll go, and his congregation all start crying, thinking they'll never see him again. But then they start giving him rings to touch onto relics. Now, the relics are the bones or possessions of saints, and they're sort of like radioactivity. They're full of holy power. So if you've got something and you touch it against the shrine, that object now has all that power in it, and it suddenly becomes extremely valuable. And he's got a bag full of bits for various friends that he's got to touch against all these different relics, and he's got to hide it because some of them are quite valuable, and it's breaking the custom rules of the time in some places. But he gets back, so they all get their bits back. Everybody has a great celebration. He's extremely proud because he's never cut his beard in the whole time he's been there. But because he's a Dominican monk, he has to cut it off. But he leaves it as long as possible. And he keeps the clothes he wore on the pilgrimage all nicely folded up under his bed as a souvenir. That's the sort of effect it could sort of have on you in those days.
Excellent. The book is called...
People Today...
Yeah.
You know, people today, there's loads of Facebook groups I watch, I keep an eye on. And there are people today who will have these wonderful experiences, and it does change, at least for a certain amount of time, maybe. It must have been exactly the same. After all, I mean, nowadays we can learn foreign languages at school, but your average, say, Marjorie Kemp, she wouldn't have known a foreign language. It must have been very, very frightening.
She was speaking in tongues on a regular basis, what are you on about?
Yes. But the trouble is, nobody else understood her.
This is also, you haven't heard my Spanish, Michael. I mean, that'll get that one going as well.
Nowadays, you can get out your phone and you'll talk into it and hold it up, and the person can actually read what you've just said in their own language. I mean, none of that was happening. It must have been extremely scary for a lot of people to go across all these different countries and no idea what people are talking about. You're not sure if you're being taken for a ride on anything. You don't know whether you've got any. I mean, it'd have been very, very tough.
What are you hoping that people will learn and discover from The Medieval Pilgrim?
Well, a bit about why people did it. Some of the downsides, as I said, about these dodgy saints and things like that. Certain extent, also the abuses of the church with relics and indulgences, but it was another way of life. I mean, as they say, the past is another country. Even looking back to when I was a kid, things have changed a lot. So we've got 500, 600 years on. This is how life was. I mean, it's just completely different. It's interesting, and there's funny bits as well. So, I mean, it was life, but not as we know it, Jim.
Ah, brilliant. The book is called The Medieval Pilgrim. It's by the brilliant Michael Brown. Michael, and you can order it, listeners, via our own virtual bookstore. If people want to find you online, Michael, where's the best place to track you down and pay homage to?
Well, I have got a Facebook page called The Medieval Pilgrim, funnily enough. And if you want the book, I mean, I don't know where you the best place.
They can
in
go
Spain
to our
to
website. Go to our website. Click on the front cover, and it'll be winging its way to them. How's that for a deal?
Oh gosh, brilliant! That is a miracle, isn't it?
It is indeed a miracle, Michael. The book is called The Medieval Pilgrim. It's by Michael Brown. Michael, it's been an epiphany to speak to you today.
Right, thank you very much, Giles.